you're familiar with it.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. I am opening this meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development on Thursday, February 22nd, 2018. And I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1554, the Higher Education Savings Account. And I would like to invite, Laura, actually, to give us a summary.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1554A would disregard any amount in an account established for higher education expenses for the purpose of determining an individual's eligibility to receive any assistance or benefit authorized by law. The bill would also require the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to conduct a study on the effects of excluding account balances from determinations of expected family contributions for higher education expenses. There are no amendments to this bill. It does have an indeterminate fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you very much. Rep. Solman, how are you?
Good.
Treasurer Reed, would you like to come up?
Sure.
Now, this is a former chair of this committee, so everybody please listen up
with
proper respect.
Thank you for the invitation. I just came on down. Chair Reardon, members of the Higher Education Committee, for the record, I am State Representative Janine Salmon, representing areas of Banks, North Plains, Hillsborough, and Beaverton. I am testifying in support of Senate Bill 1554A, and I would recommend looking at Senator Haas's testimony in OLUS, as he articulates the bill very well. In a snapshot, the goal of this legislation is to help lower income families save for post-secondary education by removing some of the barriers that people face when they are using 529 accounts, such as the Oregon College Savings Plan. Under the current law, families could be in danger of losing public benefits if they have a modest amount saved in those accounts. That fear alone could discourage families from efforts to plan for their higher education future to help them work towards achieving a living wage job. Senate Bill 1554 helps remove the barriers discussed above by excluding funds saved in one's Oregon College Savings Plan account from an asset test for various public benefits. Federal law already excludes these savings accounts from SNAP benefit eligibility, and bill changes Oregon law so that this account wouldn't affect eligibility for TANF and housing assistant and most other state-provided benefits. This bill, however, does not apply to asset tests for state financial aid programs like the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the Oregon Promise. That means that some families still may not open one of these accounts in fear that it may disqualify them from those benefits. To address that issue, we have tasked the HEC for help with studying the effect of excluding funds in these accounts to asset tests for state financial aid programs. HEC will also have to study policies the state could implement to encourage lower income families to use these accounts at a higher rate. A report on HEC's findings will be delivered to the legislature by December 1st, 2018, so that we can draft legislation in advance of the 2019 legislative session. I thank Treasurer Reed for his leadership on creating a culture of savings in Oregon, and Senator Haas for the great work he has done on this bill and his commitment to removing some of the barriers for Oregonians and their post-secondary education planning. I look forward to bringing this bill through the House. I urge a do pass recommendation to the House, to the floor of the Oregon House floor. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Treasurer Reed.
Thank
Welcome.
You, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed, in the honor of serving as state treasurer. It's good to see you all from this side of the dais. You look good. You look like a solid committee. I haven't been following enough of your work this session, but it's nice to see you from here. There's not a lot for me to add to the eloquent testimony the representative has offered. I would just echo the notion that the intent is to remove barriers that anyone might feel towards savings. You all know well the impact that having a college savings plan can have. A study from Washington University in St. Louis that indicates having an account makes a person three times as likely to go to college and four times as likely to graduate from college regardless of how much is in the account. So we just want to make sure that, that people are not feeling any reluctance that, that we can affect as to starting their account. The only other piece to add is that this this bill received unanimous support of the Senate and support from the Oregon Student Association and a number of other advocates. So I hope it will also meet with your approval. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Rep. Noble.
Thank you, Chair. I think I understand and am very supportive of the asset not being counted towards SNAP or any other public assistance. I'm going to run a scenario by and see if this is part of the bill or part of the study. When I was much, much younger and had kids, and I was open to savings 529 plan, I found that when it came time for my oldest son to go to college, that what I had saved actually ended up increasing my family contribution to my son's college as opposed to reducing it. All it did is reduce the amount of aid he received. My family contribution stayed the same plus what I had already saved. Would that change this dynamic, or is that for later?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rudin, you asked the question in exactly the right way for me to give you a very short answer. That's part of the study.
Okay.
It is a legitimate issue and one that we'd like to know more about. The easier part that we're trying to solve right now is to make sure that we're not putting people in a position of having to choose between poverty now or it's not quite the same as poverty, but reducing your education savings now in order to get access to other sorts of benefits. We want people to be able to retain those benefits while they might be going through a hard time.
Very good. Yeah. Any other questions? Rep. Clem.
Thanks. Mr. Treasurer, how heavy are in, you got us into Bitcoin. How much? Come on. Honestly, seriously.
That would be a zero.
Dude, there was a huge run-up. You don't play?
Not, Mr. Chair, Representative Clem.
People's
we're investing
money?
For the long term.
Oh, okay. That's a good slogan, right? For the long term.
Chasing the latest
fad. We could have fixed first.
Colleges in Iowa, is that what you're thinking?
I didn't say anything about any colleges except in the higher nice. Education savings context.
Okay. Cryptocurrency, I think it's hot.
Thank you for your advice.
For my tip.
I'll bring that to our chief investment officer.
Oh, sorry.
Are you?
I haven't done that for a while.
Well, that's all the questions. I want to thank you, though, for your work. I know you're always paying attention to how do we help people, put them in a better position to take care of themselves. And I think back to your work on retirement savings plans, and this is sort of similar.
It is.
In my mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah,
thank you.
He does do pretty good.
We have Mr. Thomas.
Do you feel good now?
Yeah.
You feel better about yourself?
Only if we were in some crypto. That's the way.
Good afternoon, Chair Reardon and members of the committee. My name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward and thank the Treasurer and Senator Haas for sponsoring it, particularly as it pertains to the amendment that's part of the Angros copy in front of you today. As the bill was introduced, it was actually pretty clear that there was a fairly large technical challenge that potentially stood in the way of HEC actually excising 529 assets from a student's estimated family contribution for state aid. And that is that the federal FAFSA form does not differentiate between 529 plan assets and other investments that are held by the family. So essentially, HEC would have had to have done a manual bench calculation for every student for which a investment asset was reported on their FAFSA, and it would have probably required a data match with the Treasurer's Office to receive that data that they currently house that we do not. So doing so would have had quite an administrative burden, especially as it relates to the short session. So that's in part why you see the amendment that's part of the bill before you. Representative Noble, to answer your question in part, and this will be explored in the broader study, yes, there is an effect to having investments on one's estimated family contribution. However, it tends not to be as dramatic as people perceive it to be. Under the current formula, it's about 5.6% of the value of investments above $20,000 that feed into the EFC estimated family contribution growth. But part of the reason that we're conducting the study is to look at those effects, but also to look and see if there are other ways, either the original legislation proposed or other ways that we will examine and report on, to increase 529 savings rates for particularly low and middle income Oregonians. Part of the knock against these plans, if there is one, is that the current incentive structures tend to support those with greater financial means saving in these plans. So you'll get some additional information about that in this study, and we're happy to conduct it, and I'll answer any questions you have.
Rep. Noble.
Thank you, Chair.
I'm going to miss her this afternoon for some reason, but yeah.
I appreciate the clarification. Just same son, oldest son. What I ended up doing is actually rolling all of my other children's 529 plans into one, and took care of that with him. But the other thing I noticed is scholarships, outside scholarships, where they work really hard to get scholarships, and that counts the exact same way and actually doesn't help the family one bit. It only reduces other aid available. I don't know if that's part of your study, but there's a disincentive then from an excellence standpoint to encourage youth to go get scholarships if it doesn't impact really the drain on the family.
Representative Noble, or Chair Reed and Representative Noble, I don't see that as part of this study explicitly. Perhaps, more broadly, we will talk about the effect of bringing more dollars to the table and what that does to EFC, which is obviously increase it. There are federal rules about ensuring that students don't receive more than their cost of attendance. Mm-hmm. And so if you get into those kinds of situations, particularly with larger scholarships, you will see a dollar-for-dollar reduction in financial aid that's provided.
Okay. Rep. Wiseman.
Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Thomas and committee, this morning in Ways and Means Education, we had an interesting conversation about the $20,000 and which tax form you're using. So Ms. Representative Parrish's question, we had about, so would this study look at that issue too? Could that be, I think to me, sitting there this morning, the solution is, it's plus or minus. Why set $20,000 of it, and the person makes $21,000, they're not eligible for the Oregon Promise. So maybe put some little flexibility with this. And my question is this study, could that look at that issue too?
Chair Reardon, Representative Wiesnet, just to explain a little bit for the committee, the discussion that occurred this morning was around the hard cap that exists for the EFC level at which a student qualifies for the Oregon Promise. That is, if your EFC is $19,999, you qualify for the Promise. If it's $20,001, you do not. I would view that as outside the scope of this study, but also a very important policy question to answer, and one that we considered towards the end of last session when we were trying to work with members on an appropriate funding level for the Promise. The idea of phasing in or phasing out, essentially, eligibility was a part of that that discussion. I expect that as we head towards the next biennium, will continue to be a point of discussion.
All right. Could follow up, please?
No, please.
Thank you. Yeah, I think I hope you will. The heck, where you had a bill or something, would look at that and make it a little more flexible. You don't want to, it was very complicated where you go back. It's actually 2 years going back and how your value or your value of your state could have changed. So I think that would be encourage the heck to look at that.
Okay. Getting all kinds of good help here today. So any other questions? Okay. Oh, where are we at? Okay, I'm closing this public hearing on Senate Bill 1554. And I'm going to wait to do the work session until all of our members are present. So we'll do that. And I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1557 and this active duty student rights. And Mr. Twigg, if you'd like to make your way forward, and Laura, if you could read the bill.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1557A would provide rights to students at community colleges, public universities, or the Oregon Health and Science University who are ordered to active duty for 30 days or fewer. It allows a student, in accordance with policies and practices for excused absences, to complete missing assignments or exams. It allows teachers to award grades without requiring students to complete assignments or exams, and it prevents missed assignments or exams that are completed after the student's return from adversely impacting the student's grades. It allows the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to adopt rules and declares emergency effective on passage. There is an A3 amendment that simply clarifies that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission may adopt rules for the administration of scholarships and grants that are funded by the Office of Student Access and Completion.
Okay, thank you. And by the way, we do expect Senator Thatcher to be joining us any moment, so but we'll get started trying to keep things moving here today. So thank you for being here, Mr. Twigg, and would you like to go ahead and get started?
Yes, sir. Chair and committee members, I'm here today as a former company level commander. This issue came to my attention on more than one occasion. Sometimes it was more egregious issues than others. Probably the biggest issue that I saw was I had a soldier come to me one time, and he said that he was going to be dropped from his master's program if he attended some required training. He had to be at this training. It was during a fielding of new piece of equipment that he had to be trained on. And so naturally, he's trying to figure out what he's supposed to do by going to his commander. And my first thought was, you know, this is illegal. There's no way that this isn't covered under something like USERRA. And after doing some research, I discovered that it, in fact, was not illegal. Okay. And in Oregon, there was no such protections. I found out that federally, over 30 days, there's protections for student soldiers if they're called up to active duty and their time requires them to be gone for more than 30 days, then there are protections. And through doing some more research, I discovered that there's many states throughout the country that actually have a similar bill to this, just for this specific purpose. I would say that a situation like that is probably rare, but it occurring even once is too many, in my opinion. These young people trying to get an education should never be hindered by their military service. If they want to get an education, they should be able to, in my opinion. So there's other issues that have come up along the way of, you know, do I even take classes because I know I have training coming up and this could affect my grade because I don't know if I'm going to be able to make up the assignments, etc. This bill covers those kind of issues, takes some of that stress off of them, and allows them to get that education that they're seeking without negative repercussions just because they have decided to serve their country, whether it's, you know, Army National Guard, Air Force, or Air Guard, Marines, Navy, whatever it may be, it's all covered. So in my opinion, I think that this should be I'm here supporting this bill, obviously, and at this time, if you guys have any questions for me, I would be happy to answer them.
Okay. And we have a couple of other people. I'm not sure if you want to stay up or finish your testimony. I have Dana Richardson and Kyle Thomas that are going to come up. So it's your choice. Stay or go.
I can vacate.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for bringing us to our attention. Appreciate that. Or maybe instead, maybe we could have Senator Thatcher join us.
That's what happens when you're running from other committees.
Oh. And Fernandez.
All right. I guess I'll
many pieces of paper up here.
Be really, I think, pretty short here. For the record, I'm Kim Thatcher. I represent Senate District 13. And I'm here before you with a great bill that, if you haven't signed onto it yet, there's still time, and it's a great bill. But you are beginning to see some of the people that are here to testify on behalf of this bill. And just real quickly, I need to point out that the Dash 3 amendment needs to be adopted. It's a, I think you can call it a kumbaya amendment, in that everybody's in agreement. It's harmonious, and it will move us forward. It's just a matter of timing, because this is a short session. So I'm hoping you can move it right along so we can concur on the Senate side, which we will do. Okay. So I will let others speak to the technicalities of that amendment. It's kind of an inside baseball that they would be better at expressing. But basically, the whole bill will help our National Guard men and women be able to serve our state, not get penalized while they're attending college, and it'll accommodate their education and without making them pay out extra money if they miss critical junctures during that time. So that's okay. The end of my testimony. I appreciate the time.
Right. Well, thank you for making it down here. I know you're probably pretty busy on your end of the building as well. So,
Representative. And Chair Reardon, I'll just be really quick. I'm a chief sponsor of the bill, and just to update folks, I think Representative Alonso Leon just signed on as a chief sponsor as well. And just quickly of why I think this issue is important. Actually, my time at the University of Oregon as a student government, a lot of my work was dedicated to getting funding for our veterans and family student organization. During my time at the University of Oregon, we had a lot of folks coming back from the war in Iraq. The notion that folks who have served our country have barriers when they're attending universities, and then they called into service and not having the opportunity to not have those barriers in front of them, this is really important for us to take care of them and make sure that this doesn't create barriers for them to accomplish their post-secondary education. That's it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony and your interest in this important topic. Rep. Alonso Leon.
Thank you, Chair. As Representative Hernandez mentioned, I signed on to this bill as a co-chief sponsor. I'm an older sister of a Marine, and I'm proud of that, and want to also help make sure that there are no barriers for any of our military branches. This bill is really important, and I particularly appreciate the fact that everybody's in support of this bill, so it should be a no-brainer. We should all support it and support our military folks.
Great. Thank you very much. Excuse me a second. I'm talking about an amendment.
Yes.
Thank you, yes. Chair Reardon, and I just wanted to echo and say thank you for the gentleman who testified, and appreciate your service. And I as well come from a strong Navy family, and to be able to have these soldiers understand that the stress that they face with their training and preparing for that job and having the stress of knowing if that they're going to fail a class because they're going to miss a test or whatnot is should be alleviated. It's unnecessary, and I think this is a really strong bill. I appreciate folks bringing this forward.
Yeah, thank you for your comments as well. Couldn't agree more.
Good afternoon, welcome. Chair Reardon and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dana Richardson. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Presidents of Voluntary Association of Oregon's Public Universities. We're here today to offer our support of this bill. It's a very nicely organized bill. You can see it goes the community college section, then the university section, then the OHSU section. There are existing provisions that mirror each other for folks that are called to active duty for more than 30 days, and then new language adopting those same similar procedures for service that's less than 30 days. So it's great. It allows us to kind of use our existing processes to help those students that are gone for shorter periods of time. So we think it's well written, other than a little tweak in the Dash A3 amendments. And you can see there that it's clarifying the HEC's rulemaking authority to apply to scholarships and grants from the HEC for the colleges, universities, and OHSU. That's why you see it in three spots. And then allowing us to have the authority over scholarships and grants that are administered by the institution. So happy to answer any questions.
So we'd be in a position to actually help the Senate get this bill right? Is that?
Can I take a pass? You do have a letter from Senator Thatcher, the sponsor, and Senator Roblin in OLAS indicating assent in adopting these technical amendments.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And go.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I am just here in part request from by the institutions, but really just to echo what Senator Thatcher said. The A3 amendment is a kumbaya amendment. It's clear that the language in the original bill as drafted was overbroad. We have no intent to exercise any authority over general education or programming or coursework or the implementation of any of the policies that are described in the bill other than state financial aid at the institutional level. And so we support the changes.
Okay, thank you. A little time management. We can, Rep. Biden, we can hold off on this vote if that's helpful. Because we're still waiting for Rep. Reschke.
Oh,
on the other vote.
Coming. Oh, okay.
So, if you need to go, do you need to go now, or
they're letting me know.
Okay. We'll just hold off and do the voting after the other hearing. We'll get everybody here.
Thank you. I apologize.
Okay. And Ricardo. Welcome once again.
Thank you, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. I'll try to keep this brief. My name is Ricardo Lujan Valerio. I am the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. I think a lot of my colleagues have expressed already the ins and outs of the bill. We are also in support of the A3 amendment. We think that it is something that, although the HEC has expressed, wouldn't practice outside of the boundaries of state financial aid. It's always good to have clarity within our statutes of what's intended. So we're in full support, and we definitely want to urge this committee to vote in favor of the bill with the amendment so that we can get concurrence in the Senate side.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your being here today.
Thank you.
Okay. Any questions, comments? All right. I'm closing this public hearing on Senate Bill 1557. And again, we'll wait to work this one as well. Still waiting for Rep. Reschke. We have another member that needs to dash off in a few minutes, so we'll just, it's that time of the session. We'll be flexible. Okay, so I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1563A regarding undocumented students' tuition equity. And Laura, if you could read that, please.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1563A would remove the requirement that undocumented students apply for official federal identification document in order to be eligible for resident tuition at public universities. It allows the board of the Oregon Health and Science University to exempt undocumented students from non-resident tuition rates. It extends eligibility for scholarships and other financial aid from public universities and OHSU to undocumented students. It allows students who are not citizens or lawful permanent residents to receive scholarships, grants, and other financial aid from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and declares an emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments to this bill.
Okay, great. Welcome.
Chair Reardon, it's been a higher education type of short session for myself, so I'm happy to be in front of you again to support HB 1563, actually SB 1563, what's called Tuition Equity 3.0. I'll be really brief. So my work actually on tuition equity started in 2006 when I was a student at the University of Oregon, and having gone from high school to the university and having seen my own friends who were undocumented not be able to attend the university because of international tuition costs that they were only allowed to pay because they weren't considered in-state residents, even though they grew up in Oregon as children and went and attended our public schools. And so I've been coming to the legislature testifying in support of the original tuition equity the Tuition Equity 2.0, and now I'm here as a state legislator supporting Tuition Equity 3.0. And I think just to talk a little bit about the technical components, the difference between the current law and this bill is that it removes the requirement for the Social Security number and the ITIN number, which is the federal identification number. It still retains all of the other requirements, having attended public education K through 12 5 years, and three of those being in high school, and providing the documentation with that, transcripts, and so it does keep everything else that I had mentioned. And, you know, regardless of where your political stance on immigration is, there's no question in Oregon that undocumented youth impact and benefit the state. In addition, $81 million in taxes come from young immigrants by pursuing education and bring a new environment and perspective to solving Oregon's problems. So the reason this bill is coming to you this session is due to the urgency for our upcoming students. Most high school seniors begin their college application and financial aid process in the beginning or middle phase of their year, and SB 1563 would eliminate barriers that some students might face now that they can no longer apply for DACA or deferred action for childhood arrivals. Two-thirds of Americans have stated that these young folks should be given the opportunity to succeed in our society, and I agree with the majority of our nation. Lastly, SB 1563 stays consistent with the original intent of providing academic opportunities for all Oregonians. The fixes proposed by this bill are ones that eliminate requirement that no other state, such as Washington, California, Texas, and other do not require that their tuition equity to do their tuition equity statutes. The second aspect came from the request of the public universities and community colleges. It allows the institutions to operate with flexibility. It does not guarantee any additional benefits, whether financial or academic, but it gives an opportunity for all to pursue an education. So I urge your support, and I have other colleagues who are, and I know that Dembro is the main carrier of this bill in the Senate, and he's here with us today, so if you have any questions.
Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wisnett, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Alonso Leon, and I am the representative for House District 22, which incorporates Woodburn, Jervis, and North Salem. As a champion on education issues and a voice for my community, I want to voice my strong support for Senate Bill 1563. As my colleagues on the Senate side and will express, the bill is essential for the success of our students currently pursuing higher education. It will bring technical amendments to our existing law that will have a huge impact for Oregon students. Students and parents in my district often tell me the higher education feels very out of reach for them. They don't feel like higher education is for them because they can't afford it. Across the state, we have students who have lived almost their entire lives in Oregon. They have gone to school here, worked here, and contributed to our state in so many ways. This year, my office has worked to assist students who have done everything right, graduated from high school or earned their GED, with multiple jobs to go to college. They did everything they were asked to do. But even with multiple jobs, they still can't afford college because our systems don't allow them to have access to scholarships or grants that other students are eligible for. There are a few misconceptions about this bill that I want to address. Some of our colleagues might believe that this bill would go beyond the original intent of tuition equity in 2013 and 2015. Let me be clear. The intent of the tuition equity has always been to afford students the opportunity of higher education regardless of where they come from. I come from a background of program development, and I know that when we design a program, we must ensure that people can truly access it. Increased benefits don't help unless people know that they are available, and tuition isn't truly equitable until all Oregonians can afford it. This bill takes meaningful steps to put higher education in reach of so many students who have been given so much to our, who have given so much to our state, and make it a better place every day. I have been in the education field for most of my professional career, and have always, and we have always talked about reaching the 40-40-20 goal. If we are truly going to reach that goal, we need all of our students able to access all the resources so that they can go to college as well. It is an important step to move forward in expanding higher education accessibility. I'm a proud sponsor of this bill, and I urge all of us to support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator, good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wisnant, committee. Usually we start with the past and go to the future, but this time we have the future and we come back to the past. I'd like to say that I'm pleased to bring this bill to you. I usually start that way, but I'm really kind of sad to have to bring this bill to you. It had its genesis in September when we learned that the DACA program was coming, it was potentially coming to an end. And I heard concerns from the colleges and universities and some of the leading immigration attorneys in the state that the way that our tuition equity statutes were crafted could put students under some serious jeopardy and actually deny them the access to tuition equity. And to explain why that is, just kind of turn the clock back to earlier years. You know, we had been working on tuition equity for a number of years. The effort started in the early 2000s when I think it was around 2003. There were a number of states that tried to do tuition equity. Texas was successful, Utah was successful, Kansas, Oklahoma, I think California that year, and then some others did. We passed it on the Senate side, were unable to pass it on the House side. Tried again in 2009, it didn't move. 2011, again, it passed on the Senate side, and then it came to the House, and it was a heartbreaker. But, you know, we had some really strong champions from both parties. Here in this chamber, the late Bob Jensen was the chief sponsor of this. On the other side, Frank Morse and Dave Nelson from Pendleton, Frank Morse from Corvallis. And but we didn't get over the finish line. In 2013, we were able to, and you know, if you take yourself back to 2013, it was kind of a different time. The Senate was looking at comprehensive immigration reform. It seemed like they had a path to it. I'm talking about the federal, the U.S. Senate. The DACA program had been created. It looked as if things were moving in the direction of comprehensive reform. And so at that time, it made sense for us to have some elements in the statute that connected eligibility for our tuition equity to federal programs. It, you know, prior to that, all the versions, and all the versions in the state that had passed it before, just called for eligibility based on the student's status in that state. You know, they generally required the student to have gone to high school in that state and graduated from that high school, and then to submit an attestation that they were, that they would seek immigration status as soon as they were legally able to do so, and that would be filed with their, with the university. In addition, obviously, they had to qualify for admission to the university, fulfill all the regular requirements. So we did that. And then in 2015, when we extended access to the opportunity grant to them, we just built it off of the tuition equity program. So if you were eligible for tuition equity, then you became eligible if you're, if your need was there for the opportunity grant as well. And the program has been very successful over the years. I think last year there were 216 students received tuition equity. Just there are a number of people now in this state who are working as teachers or counselors or just doing a variety of really good work because they were given the chance that I think we all believe they deserve. But we're looking right now, sadly, at this all being lost. You know, back in September when I started working on this, I felt pretty sure that this was going to turn out to be a wasted bill because the problem would have been fixed by now. And, you know, we in the Senate, we only get one bill. And so I was thinking, boy, did I waste my one bill for something that was going to be fixed by in Congress. But I think if you look at what's happening in D.C. right now, there is not an easy fix in sight. And I think if you look at the way that that the DACA program is being addressed, I hate to say this, but once again, these young people are being treated as collateral. They're pawns in a very political, very politicized game, and they're turning out potentially to be the collateral damage once again of a broken system. We cannot change that system, but what we can do is recognize these young people for who they are. You know, they're Oregonians. They grew up here. They went to school with your kids and mine. You know, they played sports with them. They did activities with them. And then it's time for them to graduate from high school, and they're faced with this awful reality. And I believe that we need to do what we can to protect them and to invest in them and to wait for the day that the system will be fixed. I believe in this country. I believe that we will fix this system, but we need these young people to be protected until that day comes. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about the bill or about the program or about its history. Thank you.
Thank you. Rep. Noble.
Thank you, Chair. Having worked at Linfield College when we had the news of the program, very much support my terminology here. Those who I consider are hostages, brought here as children, and us working to take care of them. I think DACA was flawed in that it didn't provide an automatic way for citizenship. So I commend that work. My concern as I read the bill, and maybe you can answer, is how broad this is, because this seems to me to essentially might be easier just to do away with out-of-state tuition and just have one tuition cost in public universities, because it applies through all the United States and U.S. territories. And then it seems, and breaking down, and maybe you correct me, it seems like we're the scholarship part, the Section 6 actually applies really worldwide. Because the requirements for high school and attendance here doesn't seem to apply like it does to in-state tuition. Any comments on that? Am I reading this wrong?
On the first part, yes, I think you are reading it wrong, in that the bill has a basic requirement that you have been in this country for 5 years, but on top of that is the further requirement that you have gone to an Oregon high school for at least 3 years and have graduated from an Oregon high school, and, you know, then all the other conditions. The eligibility for the tuition equity, which happened in 2015, the eligibility for the opportunity grant, you know, very restricted to these young people. In order to be able to do that, the universities need the further authorization to comply with that federal statute that I call out in my public testimony, I mean in my written testimony, that the universities can do that, but the legislature has to give them the formal authorization to do it, which most other states have done that. we just never did it. And so therefore, the heck and the universities came to me and asked for this to be included in the bill.
I'm going to invite our technical expert up just to join you. You're doing a great job, but he's just
yeah,
in case.
I would welcome that.
Just in case.
Thank you, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. My name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Just to expand a little bit on what Senator Dembrough says, because Rep. Noble, you have highlighted a section of the bill that I think people are finding to be most confusing and actually I think was inaccurately reported in a newspaper just the other day. State financial aid eligibility is under current law and will, after this law passes, be tied to eligibility for in-state tuition. And that is what Senator Dembrough was describing in so much as you have to graduate from Morgan High School, have to have been here a certain number of years. This provision does not change that. The reason for Section 4 in the bill is essentially out of an abundance of caution. There is a federal statute that allows states to spend money on non-citizens, state dollars on non-citizens, and provide certain benefits, provided that the state has exempted itself from that particular prohibition in federal law that prevents them from doing it. This is an affirmative statement. This language right here is an affirmative statement that we believe meets that exemption requirement. It may be essentially overkill. Just by passing this, the state, without that provision, the state might meet that requirement, but the language is there out of an abundance of caution.
Any other questions on that part?
Just a comment, and I'm not an attorney. I've read a lot of statutes in the criminal side of it. I think maybe we'll have a discussion offline because I see sub six of section one as a standalone, as well as what you identified in section four, as opposed to being tied to.
Read lines 12 through 15.
So I'm just concerned that I want to do what's right for the. For people who are here, I don't want this to be a carrot for people to take advantage anywhere in the world or anywhere in another state because we offer this to people that we care about here.
Representative Reardon, Representative Noble, that same piece of language that you've pointed out on page 2, lines 39 to 41, is just to meet that same federal exemption that I discussed in section 4. And the institutions in the HEC are not interpreting it to be in any way an expansion of eligibility. So to the extent that someone would perceive it to be an expansion of eligibility, that would lend them to get financial aid that they are otherwise currently not qualified for, that would be a kind of a mistaken assumption for a student to come to an institution.
And just to clarify, and since we have Kyle here, the requirement that they that they have met the eligibility through living in Oregon, going to an Oregon high school, and graduating from an Oregon high school, that is an overlay onto, in general, they have to have been in this country for 5 years at least. And of those five, three have to have been in Oregon. Is that how you all have been interpreting that? I mean, I think it's these are all ands there in that.
I see what you're talking about. But I think it's
Chair Reardon, Senator Dembrough's interpretation is correct. All of these requirements are additive on top of each other.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Other questions? Comments? Rep. Whitten?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, you and I can go back to the history. The bill was passed in 2013 to allow.
Came out of this committee.
Yes, sir. And I was on it as vice chair. Haven't moved anywhere since.
You did. No,
you're doing great. Great job. I had to leave. I had to leave and go to the other side because he had his designs on that chair.
Senator, the bill was passed, the tuition equity, and it was really restrictive. It said you couldn't get scholarships. you know, the conditions here, and I was just the Representative Clem, and what Mr. Thomas confirmed, that's you have to do all those, because I was reading it the same way that the good Representative Noble was doing, that you know we're going to open up free tuition to everyone in America, but we said no scholarships when we passed tuition equity. In 2015, we came back and we passed Senate Bill 932, which allowed tuition equity and the ability to apply for scholarships, mm-hmm. right?
Right. And I'll just clarify. In 2013, what we said was that nothing in this passing this bill would give access to financial aid unless we took further action, which is what we did in 2015. And that's what other states have done, too. Texas did it that way. They passed tuition. I think actually virtually every state that gives students access to their opportunity, to their need-based aid, they started with the tuition equity, and then they saw that it did a lot of good, but there are still these huge financial barriers. And especially, you know, you have a situation where somebody can move into Oregon from another state, and a year later they become eligible for the opportunity grant, which these students never do.
But they wouldn't have the three, they'd have been Oregon High School for so many years, that wouldn't have.
No, but they would be eligible under, and I'm talking about students with documentation.
Okay.
You know, they could just come here, establish residency, get in-state tuition, get access to all the financial aid.
Follow up.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in your testimony, you said that we've got 216 undocumented receiving in-state tuition now.
That's what I was told.
How many of those are receiving financial aid?
That I don't know. Do you have an idea, Kyle?
Chair Reardon and members of the committee, the number of students receiving tuition equity is not a perfect analog for the number of students that are DACA students or undocumented, and the number of students that fill out the ORSA, which is the state's financial aid application for those that are ineligible to fill out the FAFSA, is also not a perfect analog, one for one, for students who are eligible under the DACA program. So your question has been a vexing one for us to try to answer, and it has been asked many times. But the closest that we can get is providing you with the tuition equity figure.
Follow up, Mr. Kitchen.
Yeah.
Most of the scholarships, the Opportunity Grant, and the Oregon Promise, and even the Pell Grants, a lot of that's based upon income, family income, correct?
Representative Wisnett, the Opportunity Grant and the Federal Pell Grant are both based on expected family contribution.
So,
follow Oregon Promise.
Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. So, would it be assumed that the undocumented would have lower incomes applying for those scholarships?
Representative Reardon, Representative Wisnett, the number of these students that fill out an ORSA relative to the total population of people that file FAFSAs in the state is about 0.4%, if I'm remembering off the top of my head. And again, not having the information in front of me, I can't tell you exactly the answer to your question. But like FAFSA filers, there is a large bucket of these students that are in the zero EFC category. And then there is an income distribution after that that, to my recollection, was slightly lower, but mirrored relatively closely the FAFSA population.
Thank you. One more. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. Mr. Chair. The Ways and Means. And all that. Throughout the engrossed Senate Bill 1563, we're eliminating the statement that an affidavit stating that the student has applied for a federal individual taxpayer's identification number or other official federal identification document. I'd like you to comment on what exactly, so I understand the intent of that is, but when we first passed Senator Dimbrough back in 2013, we identified, some of them in the body of the House, identified that these students were not eligible for employment, and we didn't know how they were going to pay for their education. We wanted to, the minority report, which is the only one I've ever carried in this in my legislative career, said allowed them to some way to get work and some sort of legal way. So, Kim, first, why is that? What is the purpose in eliminating that throughout the bill, again, or so I understand it? And I thought originally they were not given the original bill did not allow them to have jobs, because, legal jobs.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Now, take a stab at it. The original bill certainly didn't guarantee them jobs at all. But we have many people in this country who are undocumented, who have tax ID numbers. And in a different time, filing for a tax ID number was, it didn't necessarily put you in jeopardy. But these days, there is a sense that it does put you in jeopardy. And, we see a determination to do more more arrests, more deportations, et cetera. And so there is a lot of concern. And I think many Oregonians share that concern. So that's why it's been taken out.
Follow up, Mr. Thank you, Senator. And I just make a comment that this bill here, and I'm not totally against the concept of helping these people who are here not at their own choice and want to get an education. But I think the testimony from the witness table today has said that most of these undocumented workers do pay taxes and are a significant amount of taxes they're paying. So I'm assuming they have a federal ID number. But here we're offering in-state tuition and maybe scholarships, but they may not have to pay taxes. I don't understand the purpose in taking this out of the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Rep. Clem.
I can tell you there are a lot of people who pay taxes under a ID number that isn't their own in agriculture, and they'll never get any of it back. They're propping up the whole system for the rest of us, honestly, because they're paying withholding taxes, and they can never get unemployment, they can never get Social Security, but they're paying a lot in. I forget the number, but it's $80 billion a year or something like that. So that's the scenario where people who are paying into the system aren't really able to access benefits. And they're also keeping our food prices lower, et cetera, et cetera. And so until you get a comprehensive immigration reprogram, that's not what
this bill is about.
Many parts of agriculture are doing. No, but it answers your question to how are you paying taxes if you don't have a federal ID number? It's because you've handed the grower a different green card, you've paid into the system, and then you don't get anything out of it. It's how many farmers have been doing this for a while.
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me, if I could just follow up on that point that Rep. Clem made. I'm part of an NCSL National Task Force on Immigration in the States. It's a group of about 30 of us, half D, half R. And I think everyone on that task force wants to see us get to some kind of immigration reform. There's a lot of difference about what that would look like. But, two things are sort of recurring themes on that task force. One is that, if there's any population that needs to be addressed first, it's these DACA people, the dreamers. Who were brought here as children. And the second recurring theme is that if we don't fix this immigration problem, agriculture in this country is screwed. I mean, already, frankly, it's just a real challenge to find employment to do the work. And every state that we have meetings in, representatives of their agricultural interests come, and they talk about the importance of getting a fix. But they also say, They have come to know the children of their workers, and they really value them very highly. So that's really what this bill is all about.
Chair Reardon, if I may add a comment as well. You know, there's testimony in OLIS from students and DACA recipients. I think the assumption we shouldn't make is that these are folks that have only been here 5 years and only gone to high school 3 years. I think you'll hear stories of folks who have grown up in Oregon, lived here the majority of their life, and are looking for, you know, we've invested in their K through 12 education and are looking for ways to continue that education. And on the one hand, on the other hand, federally, we have, at least previous to this federal administration, we have made commitments to DACA recipients, allowing them to come forward in a public way to apply for DACA status, and therefore receiving these documentations that allow them to work and pay into the federal taxation system, the state tax system, contributing to Oregon's general fund, which then goes on to higher education. And even if we were to look into how what was mentioned earlier, where does undocumented labor exist in the state? We know it exists. We know that they are contributing taxes in most industries, whether it's labor, agriculture, hospitality. Some of us know our own. Some of us may even have businesses that benefit from this type of labor. So I think it's important for us to consider that, you know, these are young people who grew up in this state, contribute to the state, and we should make sure to continue that investment.
Okay. Thank you very much for being here today.
Actually, can I say one last point, Reardon? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. You know, going back to the question of the Opportunity Grant, I just want to remind people that when we passed the bill in 2015, we simultaneously really increased our investment in the Opportunity Grant at that same time, because we didn't want anybody to perceive that the addition of the DACA students, the Dreamer students, for eligibility would displace any of the students who we otherwise would have had. So that was part of what we did in 2015, substantially, maybe by as much as a quarter, 25%.
Yeah, I really didn't want to move this along because we've got a couple bills to work, okay. But I sense that you'd like to make one more comment.
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. For the committee's information, Senator and I were here, Denbrough. I supported and passed between tuition equity and the next step was an opportunity grant. We changed the opportunity grant instead of first in, got the money. We said, no, opportunity grants should be based upon income. We prioritized income. And then the next thing we get is the 2015 bill that says now undocumented students can get scholarships.
Based on need. Prioritization of need, right?
They still have to comply with the EFC numbers than anybody else.
The grants would be issued on priority, and at that time,
on income.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was the chair of OSEC for 6 years. It's always been the same prioritization based on need.
No, before that was first in.
No, that's not accurate. It was based on need. There were cutoffs and waiting lists at different times where first in is a cutoff, is a waiting list. So if you applied by February 1st some years, you would be in line, and then we'd hold back money for the community colleges sometimes all the way till August. But it moved all over the place. I mean, it's been...
Yeah. It was a particular challenge for the community colleges. Yeah.
I'd like to go ahead and thank you for your testimony. Get other witnesses up here. Dana, do you still need to testify? Or? Okay, you're good. And so I'd like to invite Hans Bernard and Tim Cohen up.
Just pick a date.
Mr. Vice Chair, could I call for a quick caucus?
Good afternoon. Tim, would you like to go first? Or?
Chair, committee members, I'm going to do this real quick, and I haven't given you the courtesy of reviewing prior testimony. First one was I felt that the intersection 1, A and B, was inconsistent.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Did you? I'm sorry. I got distracted. Did you identify yourself?
Tim Cowan.
Oh, okay. I think you may have said that. I'm sorry. And then I would like to need to ask the next testifier just to keep it down to a couple minutes, if you can.
Yes. So I have three things. The first one was I felt in section 1 that A and B was inconsistent. I had a real hard time understanding that. The one on the show's intent to become a citizen, I thought was brilliant. I just wanted to give you and compliment you on that. When I wanted to teach business at the community college, and you have to have an MBA program, if I had 18 hours done and I signed an intent to finish it, I could do that without the school having a problem with the certification. So I think there's a way that we could do that too.
Right now? Could wait till he's done.
And the last thing I'm going to do, just real quick, is private colleges. Is there any issues that might come up about private schools and that type of stuff if they don't adhere to that or they choose not to? That's as quick as I can be.
Thank you.
Sir.
Thank you.
Hans. Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, Hans Bernard with the University of Oregon here on behalf of all the universities today in support of the bill. This is a bill that we testified in support of on the Senate side. There are dreamers on all of our campuses, and this bill provides necessary assurances for them to continue their education, as well as high school students in the state who are looking to our state universities for a path for their future. So I'll be brief, but urge your support of the bill. Thank you.
Appreciate your being here, and Andrew Bradley as well. It's important. Thank you, Mr. Cole. You still need a...
We're good, I think.
You're okay? Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, we have the last two people signed up, Ricardo and Maria. And as well, if you could keep it maybe the little shorter version.
Chair Reader and members of committee, my name is Maria Reyes Patiño, and I'm a student at Chemeketa Community College and a political science and Spanish major. And I'm here with Oregon Students Association to urge you to support the Senate Bill 1563. Senate Bill 1563 would allow all Oregonians the opportunity to attend college and university. The current law that exists has allowed many of my community members to succeed in their academics without worrying so much about having to make ends meet with tuition and living expenses. It would also allow universities to have flexibility on the financial assistance students can apply for. I'm sure you have noticed all the testimonies in support of this bill from your Oregonians across the state. I'm here to tell you about how not being able to benefit from this can make or break someone's education. As previously stated, I am a Chemeketa Community College student, but I have the great opportunity to have full assistance from a different state to come to school. I moved here last summer as a new undocumented youth, I would not qualify for the tuition equity. The fear of not being able to attend college beyond Chemeketa is painful, but I will always find a way to pursue higher education, but barriers make it almost impossible. That is why I advocate for the SB 1563, even if I do not qualify for it. This bill is necessary for the success of my fellow community members that identify as Oregonians in every way and that benefit from tuition equity. They deserve to have your support 100%. And no, folks that do not meet the requirements, such as myself, do not qualify for this. This bill has been catered for Oregonians, as it should. The stories I have been shared with you are the reason why I support SB 1563. And encourage the committee to pass it. Please remember our stories when voting on this bill. Thank you for letting me speak with you today.
Thanks, Maria. Appreciate your being here.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ricardo Lujan. I'm the legislative director of the Oregon Student Association. I think you heard a lot of the technicality about the bill from my colleagues in prior panels. I just want to expand a little bit more on the taxation as well on things. Representative Wisnant, the amount of folks that are right now benefiting from tuition equity compared to how many benefit from the Oregon Opportunity Grant is almost less than 1% of that pot. So I think I know one of the biggest concerns that the state had was, is this going to create a huge burden to the state financially for folks that will now have this ability and availability for these funds. And it's shown that it has not been a burden. It's been less than 1%, and it's been a steady growth that has been sustainable for the state. I also want to, you know, talk a little bit about myself. Aside from considering myself an Oregonian, I am a dreamer as well. I benefit from DACA, and I am a product of tuition equity. I wouldn't be with here working with you all almost on a daily basis if it weren't for Southern Oregon University and tuition equity giving me this ability. There's this one barrier about Social Security numbers and I-10 numbers in terms of education, and I think that there's a lot of young immigrants right now that are facing a lot of unknowns with how the federal government is addressing immigration, to the point that as a senior in high school, you can be discouraged by this simple requirement of a Social Security number or an I-10 to apply for higher education. It doesn't mean that I, as an individual, don't want to pay my taxes. I see that as my civic duty as an Oregonian. So in terms of higher education, as an immigrant, I would appreciate that my education wouldn't be jeopardized by that requirement. But as an Oregonian, I still see it as my duty to pay my taxes, to serve my state as best as I can, and to be a contributing member of the society. Even before DACA and before I was able to have a valid Social Security number, I paid my taxes as a high school student and as a young graduate of Ashland High School. This would do well for our community and for our state, and I thank you for entertaining this bill. And I urge your support both in this committee and on the House floor. Thank you.
Thank you for being here as well. Any questions? I just have to say I'm also very saddened that we are in a position where we even have to deal with a bill of this nature. We shouldn't be in this spot. We should be doing everything we can to nurture and support all students that have gone through our high school programs that just want to go on and be successful in college and continue thriving here in this country. And we've got to do everything we can to help people do that. It just, if nothing else, from a financial standpoint, it makes sense to. We've got a huge investment in young DACA folks. And why wouldn't we just continue that? I don't want to throw away this wonderful asset that we have. So anyway, we're not working this bill. Sorry. Closing public hearing on Senate Bill 1563. And then we need to go back and open a couple of quick work sessions. So I will opening a work session on Senate Bill 1554. That was the first one we talked about. That's on a higher education savings accounts. And
Mr. Chair, may we stand at ease for just a second?
I'm sorry?
Can we stand at ease for just a second?
Certainly. We'd like to stand at ease for just a moment.
Thanks.
Do I need to pound anything? Or? Just come back to order here. We are currently in a work session for Senate Bill 1554. We're going to carry that over. And so I'm closing this work session on Senate Bill 1554. And I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1557. I'm sorry.
Why?
Thinking about going home. I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 1557.
Mr. Chair Reardon, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments.
Rep. Wisnant moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments. Any discussion?
A3
amendments. No discussion? Okay. Any objection? Okay. Amendments are adopted.
Chair Reardon, I move Senate Bill 1557-A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Rep. Wisnant moves Senate Bill 1557-A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none, clerk will call a roll.
Senator Bynum.
Aye. Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Hurd.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative Reschke.
Aye.
Representative Solman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Alonzo Leon.
Yes.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair Reardon.
Aye. Motion passes. And Carrier for this one?
Who was the sponsor? It was Therese. Who was the sponsor?
Yes.
Spoke to
it. Yeah, that was one of them.
So probably Rep.
Yeah.
You want it?
I could take it.
You're here? Okay. Rep. Alonzo Leon. Thank you for, you got it. Okay. Did I close that? I think I did, didn't I? I'm closing this work session on Senate Bill 1557. And?
Yes.
State that your intention is to do this. Okay. And so just for the record, my intention is we'll come together next Tuesday. We'll have a short hearing, and we will work Senate Bill 1554A and Senate Bill 1563A. So if we all get here promptly, we will leave promptly. And that, I think, will be our last hearing.
Very important to announce.
All right,
this time.
All right, I'm closing something here. Closing this meeting of the House Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development.